From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Your mother said that she thought that maybe the people who killed him were part of a death squad, and that maybe they shot him after a barroom fight.
Today, the quest for the truth behind a death in a Guatemalan family. Who really killed Tio Alejandro and why?
Nobody wants to say anything. Finally, my brother explained to me. It's not that they don't want to tell you, but we don't supposed to talk about it.
Then a conversation with rapper Fat Joe.
You know, we talked about this 20 years ago. We said one day Latinos were going to grow at an enormous rate where you were going to have to respect whatever we're doing.
And the Sons of Anarchy spinoff, Mayans MC, and actor J.D. Pardo. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Our show is going to start with a story about family and war and the things that we tell each other about where we come from. Jesse Alejandro Cottrell has always been proud to have been named after his uncle. According to the story, in 1978, in the middle of Guatemala's dirty civil war, the government murdered his uncle, Alejandro Mendoza. He was one of hundreds of thousands who was victimized by a succession of brutal regimes.
A UN debate was dramatically interrupted Friday afternoon with the emergency announcement that 5,000 Indians in a Guatemalan village were about to be murdered by government troops.
The civil war in Guatemala lasted for over 30 years. The U.S.-backed government was fighting leftist rebels. Forced disappearances of suspected subversives were common, and many innocent people got swept up and killed at the hands of the government. Jesse grew up on this version of the story, the one where his uncle died unjustly, like a casualty of war. But when he recently visited Guatemala, Jesse started to ask some questions, and he discovered a much more complicated story than he had ever imagined. Here's Jesse.
My earliest memory of my uncle Alejandro was hearing how he died.
Your mother said that she thought that maybe the people who killed him were part of a death squad, and that maybe they shot him after a barroom fight.
And as far as my dad knew, the fight was between my uncle and the son of the mayor. But beyond that, the details were blurry. I didn't know why my uncle had fought the son of a mayor in a Guatemalan city, only that he had been standing up to what my dad called an oppressive government. He says that this is why the people who killed my uncle dressed him up in a military uniform.
And tried to say that he was a member of the insurrection there.
Even if the details weren't certain, my mother remembers very clearly the day she found out her brother was dead. She didn't find out in person or via phone call. She received an express letter in the mail from her father.
I started reading the letter. And the first thing that my father said, you know, "Dear Shani, in this letter I'm telling you that your brother Alejandro had passed away." And I'm like, God, I just stopped there. And I started crying and I probably went crazy. I don't know.
My mom then called her other brothers to ask what happened, but
nobody wanted to say anything. But later on, my brother, he said to me, when we went in the cemetery, there were some soldiers around there. And one came and talked to me, and he said, "You know, we know all your family, so just leave it like that."
His family was told not to ask questions about it at all.
But how could they not? My quest to find out what really happened to my uncle started in 2011 when I visited Guatemala for the first time since I was a kid. To my surprise, my family in Guatemala seemed as clueless as I was about how Alejandra died. No one had more than a piece or two of the puzzle, and when I put those pieces together, they still didn't fit. One of my aunts told me that Uncle Alejandro ran with a bad crowd. A cousin said that he might have been a narco. And for 5 years after that visit to Guatemala, I wondered which of those rumors was true. So this past Christmas, I decided it was time to go search for real answers, and I returned to Guatemala. The first person I visited was my cousin Estuardo, but unfortunately he knew as little as I did. Then I asked my cousin Victor, and he also seemed to know almost nothing. Then one night I went to hear my cousin's cover band rehearse, and as they played rock classics like Whip It and Love Me Two Times, I struck up a conversation with my aunt Maria Jesus. Turns out her version of who Alejandro was differed greatly from what I had heard.
Él con sus amigos era todo corazón. Él se daba...
She says my uncle was so close to his friends that he got into fights defending them, and that this noble trait was his biggest problem. When Alejandro died, two of my uncles went to the town where he was killed, trying to figure out why he died. What they found was a love triangle that ended in blood.
Lo que averiguaron fue que Alejandro andaba con unos amigos. Que uno de los amigos andaba enamorando a una muchacha de la aldea.
The night my uncle Alejandro was killed, he went to a bar with a couple of friends. Alejandro didn't drink, but one of his friends was dating the cute bartender there. What no one knew was that the woman was also dating another guy, the son of the local mayor. And it just so happened that he was also at the bar that night.
Y por esta muchacha se pelearon.
So the two men involved in the love triangle started a fight. And my uncle Alejandro immediately jumped into the fray, defending his friend with his fists. That's when he was attacked with machetes. My aunt isn't clear on how the conflict went from a fistfight to something more lethal, but she does know this is how her brother-in-law was killed. My aunt Maria Jesus says the family was at my grandparents' home when they saw the newspaper. In a large font, the paper announced that a group of guerrillas had attacked a neighborhood in Amatitlan and that the townspeople had killed one of the guerrillas.
Los de la aldea se habían defendido y habían matado a un guerrillero.
The paper reported that the slain guerrilla was my uncle, Alejandro. Whether or not this was true, this news hit my grandfather hard. Not only because his son was dead, but because of the way he was portrayed. He died looking like an anti-government fighter, and my grandpa was very pro-government. But from my aunt Maria Jesus, this is not a story of a political hero or a casualty of war. It's a story of a cover-up. To cover up the involvement of the mayor's son in a crime of passion, the police said that Alejandro was a guerrilla member.
Para poder justificar la muerte de una persona, dijeron que eran guerrilleros.
According to my aunt, they did this to justify why they defended themselves. And in those days, it was easier to get away with something like this. This was a time of war, a war that started long before my uncle's death.
A Sunday convocation that hears Guatemala's chief delegate alleged that his country is the victim of international aggression.
The Guatemalan Civil War started in 1954, when the democratically elected president, Jacobo Arbenz, was overthrown by a military coup. The U.S. government denied its involvement at the time, but decades later, declassified documents revealed that a CIA plot was behind the rebellion that ousted Arbenz. President Dwight Eisenhower's administration considered Arbenz a communist because of his land reform program, which gave unused land owned by rich people to poor people. The war raged for over three decades, leaving an estimated 150,000 Guatemalans dead or missing. Government soldiers fought various leftist guerrilla groups, mostly in the mountains. But the violence often spilled onto the streets of the capital, Guatemala City, where my mother's family lived.
I was very scared of the soldiers more than the guerrillas because the guerrillas were really good people. I'm sorry, but that's the truth. They were the students, the ones that are really looking for the poor people that didn't have anything. But my father, yeah, he didn't want us to get involved in anything because it's too dangerous. You get killed.
My grandfather wasn't alone. Lots of people had reasons to be afraid. Violence was happening all around them.
One day, I was listening to the radio or it was TV, I don't remember, but I remember that I heard that some people from the university were found dead under a bridge close to Guatemala City. It was like a big shock when I saw the name of the person.
One of the murdered women was Rogelia Cruz, a high school friend of my mom's. So this feeling of constant fear became worse for my mom when she was killed. Rogelia had won the Miss Guatemala pageant and went to the 1959 Miss Universe pageant. The brutal killing of Rogelia had been a warning posed by the government: oppose us and end up dead. But while my mom was shocked to hear how her friend had died, the death itself was less of a surprise, because she knew that Rogelia and her boyfriend had been on the side of the guerrillas and against the government.
And so that's the way you live in a civil war. And the thing is this, if you speak out your mind, you know, they will kill you.
After talking to my aunt Maria Jesus and for the rest of the trip, I felt deflated. My uncle hadn't died standing up to an oppressive government. He was killed in a crime of passion. I asked a few other relatives if the story Maria Jesus had told me was true. They mostly nodded their heads. So at that point, I left Guatemala and I stopped asking questions about who my uncle was and how he died. But by the time I got home, I realized that there was one more person I needed to talk to.
Coming up on Latino USA, Jesse talks to his uncle Alejandro's son, and here's a much different story. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, bridging science and the arts by supporting the history of scientific theory misused in the Eugenics Crusade, premiering October 16th on PBS. More at sloan.org. And Pew Charitable Trusts, celebrating 70 years of serving the public. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/70.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And when we left off, reporter Jesse Alejandro Cottrell was searching for the truth about his uncle Alejandro, the man that he was named after. His aunt in Guatemala told him that his uncle died after getting in the middle of a love triangle, and that his body was dressed up as a gorilla afterwards as a way of a cover-up. But then Jesse got in touch with his cousin, Alejandro.
Mi nombre es Alejandro Mendoza Maldonado. Tengo 42 años.
This Alejandro is my cousin and the son of the Uncle Alejandro, the one who was killed. I'm going to call him Alex, which he also goes by, just to make things easier. Alex had a difficult childhood because before my uncle was killed, his mother died of an illness. So he was raised by our grandparents, and they didn't tell him much about how his dad died.
A él lo habían matado en una finca en Amatitlán. Hasta ahí, no más me habían contado.
Alex says all he knew was that his dad was killed on a farm in Amatitlán. That was all they told him. They didn't tell him why or how his dad was killed. In other words, as a kid, my cousin knew even less about his own father's murder than I did growing up in the United States. Alex's memories of his dad seemed distant to him.
Son cosas muy lejanas que me acuerdo de él.
At the age of 21, Alex joined the Fuerzas Armadas Rebeldes, or FAR, one of the main guerrilla groups fighting the Guatemalan army. Alex was in college at the time, so instead of wielding a gun, he was in charge of recruiting and educating students to the group's political ideology. Alex remained a member of the FAR until 1996 in a sort of administrative position, never in combat. A year later,
Central America's longest and most brutal civil war has come to an end. For the past 36 years, leftist rebels had battled Guatemala's army.
Peace was finally negotiated between the government and the various guerrilla groups, so he left the armed forces. And as part of the peace accords, all guerrillas had to present themselves before the local United Nations mission to formally accept the deal. But when Alejandro's name was called, he stood up and was shocked by what the woman reading his name said to him.
Me dijo, no es posible que sea usted. Si soy yo, yo me llamo Alejandro Mendoza. Pero no, si usted murió en el 78, me dice.
The woman told Alex that he couldn't possibly be the man she called. He said, yeah, that's me, Alejandro Mendoza. The woman told him, but you died in 1978. Alex asked the woman to read the maternal last name of the man on her list.
¿Cuál es el otro apellido? Le pregunté yo. Entonces me dijo que era apellido Mora.
She said Mora.
Entonces le dije, era mi papá.
That's when Alex realized she was talking about his father. Alex heard the UN read off the name of two more family members that day, but he wasn't sure whether to believe that so many relatives were secretly guerrillas.
En esos tiempos, mucha gente venía y te ponía en la lista para decir que la guerrilla tenía tanto...
Alex says that guerrilla fighters inflated their membership roles with innocent civilians so that they would seem bigger than they really were, even if those civilians had no affiliation with the insurgent groups in real life. So it was difficult to know whether my uncle Alejandro or anyone else in the family was actually involved in the war. Like me, my cousin's curiosity grew as he got older, and a few years later, he started his own investigation into what really happened to his dad. His quest took him to Amatitlan, the town where the family recovered his father's body. He spoke to retired guerrillas in the area and local law enforcement, and the story he pieced together was very different than the one Maria Jesus told me. This story makes more sense if you consider how dangerous Guatemala was in those days and why my family might have wanted to hide the real reasons for my uncle's death.
Bueno, por lo que yo averigüé de mi papá, de que había fallecido, que había sido una incursión guerrillera en una finca.
From what Alex discovered, his dad died on a farm while trying to collect the famous war tax. The war tax was what the guerrillas charged farms in rural areas to help support themselves. But it was mostly imposed on people, so it was more like extortion than donation. And this is where it gets complicated. Somebody must have alerted the locals that my uncle and his friends were coming, because when they arrived, members of the military were there waiting for them.
Cuando ellos entraron, fueron que los agarraron. Y ahí fue donde lo que sucedió con mi papá, pues que lo mataron a él y dos compañeros más.
People ambushed them and grabbed his father as soon as they entered the farm. Alex says that this is where his father was killed.
A mi papá, sí lo mataron a machetazos.
They hacked my uncle Alejandro to death with a machete. They hacked his neck. They hacked his chest until his heart hung out of his chest.
Tenía el corazón de fuera.
So one version of the story has my uncle dying in a bar fight, one that started because of a love triangle and ended with the government accusing my uncle of being a guerrilla fighter. The other version is that he was a guerrilla fighter who was extorting people and ended up mutilated by the military. Given how different these two stories are, I asked my cousin about the origins of the bar story. After all, the barroom version wasn't in any newspaper. It was what my uncles told us.
Vinieron personas a amenazar de que no fueran a hablar de lo que había sucedido porque podía pasar algo peor.
My cousin says that after his father died, people threatened the family and told them all not to talk about what happened. Alex thinks maybe this is when our family decided to tell the love triangle story instead, and he says it's okay for them to have their version. He's keeping his.
Que ellos se queden con su versión, que yo me quedaré con mi versión.
I don't know if in the end, my uncle Alejandro was a hero or a villain. I'd heard that the fog of war creates situations like my uncle's where the truth can't be found. What I didn't expect was that people could come to prefer this fog. For my mom, excavating such awful stories about her brother is something she wants to avoid, which is partly why she's only returned to Guatemala a handful of times in the last 40 years.
And I noticed that some people said that to me. Why are you? I said, I don't want to go. I don't want to remember that stuff. It's ugly.
It's strange to hear my mom say that. By naming me after my uncle, my mom ensured that neither of us would ever forget his murder. Names, like memories, can be powerful.
Thanks to reporter Jesse Alejandro Cottrell for that story. And now, we're going to turn to an interview that I recently did with one of the most noteworthy names in hip-hop history. In the early 1990s, a young MC from the South Bronx exploded onto the hip-hop scene. His name was Jose Antonio Cartagena, a.k.a. Fat Joe. Fat Joe is a rapper of Puerto Rican and Cuban descent, and if you don't already recognize his debut single, Flo Joe, you gotta let him know, Joe, then I'm pretty positive you'll recognize these hits. Got to do.
Lean back. Come on, I said, what up?
This year, he'll be releasing a new album called Family Ties with Dre of the production duo Kool & Dre. But along with over two decades in music, Joe has also begun to create a steady career in acting, most recently in the 2017 Netflix series, She's Gotta Have It.
I want to dance.
Is you bugging out, Shemeca? You want to dance? You see them girls professional.
Yeah, and I want some stage time, just like...
And in the new comedy, Night School, starring Kevin Hart and Tiffany Haddish.
If you're not going to do the work, drop the class.
No, I'm going to do the work. You'll see.
The movie is a story about a group of misfits attending night school in the hopes of getting their GEDs. And in it, Joe plays the character of Bobby, who's an inmate who joins the night class through Skype. Fat Joe and I talked about his experience of growing up in the South Bronx, his beginnings in hip-hop, and about his new role in the film Night School. You know, the first time that I heard about you was when I was in the Bronx with a group of guys known as the Tats Crew.
Oh, yeah, that's my crew.
Love those guys.
We've been together over 20-something years. And so Tats Crew was really T-A-T. And then T-S is Terror Squad. And we merged the crews together. We both used to write graffiti back in the days. And that's how it became the Tats Crew. It's part of Terror Squad.
They're known as the best memorial wall artists in the Bronx. And now they even have a budding graphic arts company.
I was a reporter here at NPR. I was the first Latina correspondent at NPR.
This first wall, they point out, is about 14 feet high and 8 feet wide. It's a huge, spray-painted, blossoming red rose.
They used to joke and say that I was the Bronx bureau chief because I love spending time in the Bronx because, you know, at that time, the Bronx was very misunderstood.
This is how many years ago?
1995.
Yeah, that was the time. They call them mural kings. In the Bronx, when somebody who's really loved in the neighborhood passes away, we do murals for them. The only tattoo I have in my arm is in memory of Tony, my best friend who got killed in the Bronx. We have one of the most famous murals in the Bronx. The Tats Crew did it, and it was of Tone, and it looked just like him.
I saw it.
Yeah, and it's crazy because it lasted for so many years. It was in movies and everything.
Makes me think about the fact that you were in the Bronx at a time when, you know, it was rough, right? There was a lot.
Yeah, when I grew up
in
the Bronx, we just...
It was scary sometimes, but also there was so much love, right?
Growing up in the Bronx, although I grew up so poor. So when they try to do stories on me and documentaries, they always ask me for pictures from when I was a little kid. And when... I go around all the time to my family, like, do you have any pictures of I was a kid? You have any pictures? I can't find none. So one day I asked my Uncle Angel, he's a pastor. And, you know, he should never lie, right? So I went up to Uncle Angel. I said, yo, Uncle Angel, why is it we don't have no pictures of when I was a kid? He was like, yo, we were so poor, we didn't have a camera. That's the answer. I was like, wow, we was that poor. But I also remember that time, family getting together every Sunday, family enjoying each other, everybody loving each other. Violence wasn't so bad. I mean, you know, this is, I'm talking about disco. I'm talking about the Bee Gees.
What's your favorite disco sound?
Man, I don't know. I love Franz Joly. Mm-hmm. Come to me.
Mm, God, I love that.
Da, na, na, I remember okay. that growing up. It was something else.
There's a thing that happens, though, after this like really great period where you're perhaps not understanding how challenged mm-hmm. you are economically. Mm-hmm. But the violence does start to come, right? Mm. What was your understanding then of why that was happening in your community?
Well, what happened was bullying was at an all-time high, especially me being a Latino. I grew up in a neighborhood that was like 99% black, and they had never seen a Latino like me because I was like the conquistador. I would never take no disrespect from nobody. Yeah. Story takes place back in the South Bronx. We're at the age of 14. I was already knocking off. In the hood, if you want to call it the Bronx, the more people respected you and feared you, the more powerful you felt. So that was like the first time I felt power. And so I remember, you know, for all the wrong reasons, my name and reputation was getting out there so much that I remember going my first day to high school. And I walked to the high school with about 150, 200 kids the first day. And I remember everybody just in the background like, who's that? That's Joey Crack. That's Terror Squad. It's Fat Joe. It's just, and I was just, my ego was just boosting to another level to where you have all the girls like, but who is he? And they was like, you know, that's Fat Joe. That's before rap music, just for being a bad guy in the hood, you know? It's crazy.
Tell me about your mom and dad. Like, what were they doing?
Well, my mom's is Puerto Rican. My dad is Cuban.
Each born on each island?
Yeah, my mother was born in Puerto Rico but came over here to the Bronx since she was 6 months old. When my father came over here, his sister lived right over my mother's crib. And, of course, he seen my mother, blonde hair, green eyes, you know, beautiful.
Blonde hair, green eyes.
Yes.
Puertorriqueña.
That's right. She fell in love with my father. You know, he's a charmer. He was on her. And they've been together ever since.
Aww.
And thank God they're still together now.
How many years?
Jesus Christ. I'm 48. They've been together at least 52
wow.
years or something. And they are inseparable. They're like, they're no good. Like, you can't argue with one. You can't put my mother against him. You know, she's with him, like, all the way.
What's
love? Got to do,
got to do. What's the lesson for you of that long-term relationship?
Well, that's why I've been with my wife 23 years, man. That's why I've been with my wife 23 years. Family is so important to me, man. It's a hard, hard fight to be together. It's so easy to just walk away from each other. You know, it's so important for the Latino kids watching what's going on. We like letting them know that, you know, this is possible. And hip-hop.
All right, so let's talk about your beginnings in hip-hop. Like, did you have any hip-hop heroes when you were growing up?
I was just at the Hispanic Heritage Awards, and I had the honor of giving an award to Crazy Legs Cologne. Crazy Legs Cologne is like a superhero to me. He's like Superman, Batman. Growing up in the Bronx and being so in love with hip-hop music, he was really the only Latino icon at the time. And he was 10 years old. He was already a legend. He was a myth. He was somebody you couldn't see. You couldn't. He was Crazy Legs, Rock Steady. And you was like, oh, my God. And he was there at the birth. So when I started doing rap music, they would call it black music. Right? And I was like, yeah, black music. 20 years later, after rapping, I go back to the early days of hip-hop music. Half of the jams was Latino. Half of the jams was black. So the black dude was rapping, but DJ Charlie Chase was DJing. Ruby D, all these Latinos was in there. So I was like, I had to go back and be like, yo, this ain't black music. This is black and Latino music originally. Now it's everybody's. You know, we never had like no rap Latino superstars till, I want to say Cypress Hills, and then Fat Joe and Big Pun came along. I support Pun in anything he does, anything he loves. A brother from another mother sent for the above. Then we had Curious George, we had the Beatnuts, we had a bunch of guys that were putting dents in the game. You know, when they asked me recently about Trap Espanol and everything that's going on, it's, you know, we talked about this 20 years ago. We said one day Latinos were going to grow at an enormous rate where you were going to have to respect whatever we're doing. And that's a fact now.
So can you just take us to the point where, you know, you in the beginning of your career, the record companies, they were all saying, no, there's no market for Latinos in hip hop.
I could tell you some crazy thing. I had to fight to get rap music in the Puerto Rican parade. So there was this guy named Ramon Velez, and he ran the parade. And I would go to him every single year and be like, yo, Latinos love hip hop. As far as hip hop, I'll never take the route of saying, you know, it was harder for me because I was Latino or whatever the case may be, because sometimes I think I got more black fans than even Latino fans. I've been embraced. I started out in the Apollo Theater. I went to amateur night. I won 4 weeks in a row. I came in first place. That's where I met Red Alert. I gave my demo to, and he played it on the radio, and it became my first single, Flojo, that went on to go number one in America. So I never used the I'm Latino card. I just always felt like if you're talented, if you're a musical genius, just put your music out and it'll speak for itself.
You know, one of the things, Joe, when you talk about letting things speak for themselves, I think it's something that people really appreciate about you is your honesty about a lot of things. And obviously, we've been experiencing it just in our conversation. Yeah. You talked about after the death of your dear, dear friend, Big Pun, that you actually went through a depression.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering why choose to talk about that and what...
Even though my music is hardcore and it's gangster and it's whatever, you know, I was always hoping that people could see me for who I am. I just want everybody to learn something from me. Depression is a very, very serious thing. And my grandfather died, my sister died. She gave birth, she was in a coma for like 8 months. I had to see my mother at the hospital with my sister every day trying to wake her up. Big Pun died. They all three of them died around the same week. And it was just too much for me. Another thing, if somebody dies right now, we try to go to a quiet place, gather ourselves, get back in the game. I couldn't do it with Big Pun. So any restaurant I went to, the waiter was like, sorry about your brother. If I was stuck in traffic, the car next to him, yo, we love Big Pun. Yo, so it was a constant. So I went to a psychiatrist, and she helped me understand myself on so many different levels. So I went to her for 2 years. And I remember one day, every year, the Tats Crew does a mural for Big Pun in the Bronx on 163rd and Kelly. And we was out there that night, and we was doing the mural. And then two dudes walked by, and one dude told the other dude, yo, what they doing out here? And it was in the middle of the night. He was like, oh, that's the mural for Big Pun. They do it every year. Do you believe it's 2 years since he died? And it just ricocheted like an echo in my brain that just said, 2 years, 2 years, 2 years, 2 years, 2 years. And I woke up right there. I had a depression right there. I said, oh, no. I got crazy overweight. I never used to drink before that. I was drinking a bunch of liquor. Man, it was destroying my life. So, you know, I'm able to tell people, look, I came out of it.
I'm so thankful that you speak about this, Joe. I really, really appreciate it.
We definitely got to talk about night school. That's the whole...
Well, so, how, that was the next thing.
Night school!
That was the next
September
thing.
September 28th.
Let's do some introductions. My name is Carrie. I'm here to make a little extra cash so that I can afford this warrant that I got. But that's none of y'all business. Welcome to night school.
I was cracking up!
No, night school's so funny. It's a bunch of guys going back to school and ladies to get their GED. And Tiffany Haddish is the teacher.
You all should be very familiar with the Pythagorean theorem. All right? Say it with me.
Pythagorean theorem.
That's how you say it?
And it is hilarious.
We love
Tiffany.
And
this is one of the only big movies coming out that has two Latinos in the forefront.
They had the wrong guy.
You got Fat Joe, of course.
You sure you cool, or do we need to just chill and wait for you to make a new shank?
Please continue with the Pythagorean theorem.
And then you got a guy named Al Madrigal. If you see how hilarious this guy is, nah, you got to see it.
He's been on our show a lot.
Him and Kevin Hart going at it like crazy, and I'm like, this is hilarious.
You're having a good time being an actor, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We've been acting our whole life. So what happens is the camera's on now.
Joe, it was fabulous speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Rapper and actor Jose Antonio Cartagena, a.k.a. Fat Joe. He's in the new film Night School, and his new album, Family Ties, will be out later this year. Coming up on Latino USA, how our environment leaves its imprint on us, even when we don't expect it. Pollution and the neurological effects on children. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, working to outsmart cancer through the use of genomic testing to profile each individual's cancer and reveal possible treatment options. Learn more about precision cancer treatment at cancercenter.com and the Zimmel Family Foundation, supporting the National Center for Learning Disabilities, which works to improve the lives of 1 in 5 individuals with learning and attention issues. Learn more at ncld.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. When we talk about pollution, we often think about our physical health, things like our lungs, our skin. But what about our brains? Just this last year, a nationwide study was released, the first of its kind, that looked at the neurological effects of pollution on children in schools across the country. The researchers tested for exposure at around 85,000 U.S. public schools, and they found that the schools with large black and brown populations were disproportionately affected by pollution. I sat down with Sarah Elizabeth Grineski, who co-wrote the study, to talk about her findings. Grineski is based in Salt Lake City, Utah, but I decided to start first by recording my own observations of pollution outside of our offices in Harlem. And I asked Sarah for her impressions.
All right, so it's 1:52 in the afternoon. We're right here on 125th Street. You can hear the announcement of the bus right behind us. So one bus, wow, let me see. I see one small little kind of hospital bus, a school bus right behind that. a regular city bus behind that, a van, a truck, another double-sized bus. And this is just 1 second on 125th Street.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're located right there in the center of a lot of traffic and, you know, city life. I mean, Salt Lake City, we also, it's a pretty big city here. We have, you know, a fair amount of traffic pollution and buses and everything. But what I was actually thinking about when you were talking about what's outside are just all of the health risks associated with those different exposures that you were hearing. And not only the respiratory risks for our breathing, but also, you know, cardiovascular effects and what my research has been focusing on, which is, you know, neurological effects and how air pollution actually can harm our brains.
So that gets really scary. I got to be honest with you.
It does.
Because I'm like, okay, first of all, I feel like a terrible mother because I dared raise my kids in New York City, in Harlem. But also, it just makes me wonder about what this has done to my own brain. So what do you mean exactly? Because that sounds quite shocking and quite scary.
The working theory now, coming from neurologists, is that when you breathe in the pollution, for example, through your nose, and it damages the nasal and lung epitheliums and allows the pollution to enter your body. That then generates an immune response, which causes tissue swelling and immune cell release of cytotoxic species, and then it can lead to diffuse loss and damage of neural tissues.
Okay, and for those of us, like, okay, I was raised with a scientist, so I got a little bit of that, but then there's a lot of people who are like, okay, I feel like I lost some brain cells just getting that interpretation. What it really means is that if you're breathing in air that's contaminated, it can find its way to your brain. And essentially, you're saying it slows us down?
Well, yeah, it causes inflammation, which damages our brain and changes the way that it functions. There's a medical doctor. She's at the University of Montana, Dr. Calderon Garcidueñas, and she actually does work in Mexico City. And she does autopsies on otherwise healthy youth that are basically, you know, killed in traffic accidents or other accidental deaths. And she's looked at their brains and she's compared their brains to the brains of youth who have died of similar causes in less polluted Mexican cities like Veracruz. And she basically finds that they have brain structures that resemble people who have early stage Alzheimer's disease. So she can actually visually see in the brains of these young people, these changes, which she believes are tied to the air pollution that the children must be, you know, breathing in as they live their lives in a heavily polluted city like Mexico City.
So in the report, the term environmental justice is talked about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been around for a while. But just to make sure, because there are different definitions, what exactly, in your view, is your definition of environmental justice?
Well, the paper that we published in Environmental Research takes a perspective on distributional environmental injustice, which has to do with how, you know, health-harming pollution is distributed in space and then how certain social groups are disproportionately exposed to that pollution in their neighborhoods or, in our paper, in their schools.
So, Sarah, just to kind of end on this concept of environmental justice, what might justice look like for these communities that are challenged?
I think it's really tricky because we can't just shift the pollution around. There's evidence that as the environmental justice movement was achieving some success in the 1970s and the 1980s, where, you know, our backyards were getting at least somewhat cleaner in certain parts of the United States, that basically what was happening was these burdens, like waste incineration, was shifting from the United States to other countries. So it's that not in my backyard versus not on planet Earth, right? And I think moving towards that nope, that not on planet Earth, whereby we make very conscious decisions to protect our children, you know, remedy environmental injustices that have been perpetrated against people of color in this country for a very long time, has to happen in terms of reducing the pollution everywhere and for everyone, and not just, you know, shifting it on to some other less powerful person who then has to deal with it.
Sarah, thank you so much for all of your research. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So Sarah Elizabeth Grineski is one of the researchers behind the National Pollution Study. She's a researcher and professor at the University of Utah. And now, for the fans of the Hulu original series Islos Hay, Emmy-nominated actor J.D. Pardo, who played Jesus, is back in a new FX series, Mayans MC. It's the next chapter in the Sons of Anarchy saga. Like Sons of Anarchy, Mayans MC, or Motorcycle Club, was co-created by Kurt Sutter and portrays the high-stakes world of these outlaw clubs. But this time, he brought on a nearly all-Latino cast, and the story is set along the U.S.-Mexico border in Southern California. According to Nielsen, Mayans MC was the most-watched cable series premiere of 2018. In the show, J.D. Pardo plays Ezequiel Easy Reyes, the lead character. He's a prospective member of the Mayans Motorcycle Club who was formerly incarcerated and is now figuring out life outside of prison. In this edition of How I Made It, J.D. talks about his career and his new role as Easy.
The one time I played a gangbanger was on Islos Hay. But now that I'm playing this with Mayans, I've been hit up with some of that too about, oh, like, aren't you tired of representing our people this way? And that's just not true. I've been working really hard against that. You know, it's not like I made a career out of playing these roles. I've played white roles. I've played Jewish roles. I've played half black, half white. I've played transgender roles. I've played a lot of different characters. My name is J.D. Pardo. I'm born and raised in Los Angeles, Panorama City. A kid from the San Fernando Valley. Father's from Argentina, mother's from El Salvador. They're my number one fans. You know, I think in the beginning it was that I was just so fascinated with going to the movies. You know, we didn't have a lot of money, and it was such a treat to go to the movie theaters and, you know, to get that popcorn and to get your candy and the soda and to sit there and watch a movie. It was just, you were just transported to another world. And I always had in my mind, like, I wanted to do that. That's, whatever that was, that's what I wanted to do. And I just didn't know how to go about it. But when I was 13 years old, my parents divorced and my dad left the house, and it was just myself and my two sisters, my mom. So I was so angry with my dad, and so I was just very angry. And I found sort of the safe place when I took a drama class. The second I was there, I felt it went from fantasy to this grounded place of having this desire, this need to express myself, whatever was going on. I had something to say, a place to just be somebody else, somebody that I wasn't, and just to use everything that was inside of me and to express that. And it felt so good that I just had to do it again. My parents wanted us to be educated in a way that they weren't. They wanted us to, you know, go after the American dream. This was the land, this land of opportunity. You know, that's why they came here. So you can imagine how disappointing it was when I told them I wanted to be an actor. I just came out and just told them that I wasn't going to college. I wanted to be an actor. But it really did feel like I was coming out of the closet, you know, like an actor's closet. When I heard that they were doing Mayans, that this sequel or a spinoff to Sons of Anarchy, I was like, ooh, 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 yeah, I want to check that out.
Right into this world, all alone.
I binged watched Sons of Anarchy. It started off with just one episode, and then next thing I know, I go through all seven seasons in a matter of like 4 days to a week.
The crow flies straight.
And I was like, I have to be a part of this show.
Perfect line. On the day.
With Mayans, obviously bike culture is what's similar. We're both motorcycle clubs. And so I had to go to Glendale Harley School and take the course there for a weekend. You know, I didn't ride before, Then the following week, I'm on this Softail Deluxe with 22-inch ape hangers. The fans want the real thing. So we all ride. We all ride. That's a big part of it.
Need you on this Vegas run.
Dresses?
You good with that?
Yeah, whatever the club needs.
For me, when it came down to easy, Kurt Sutter, the creator of our show, wanted me, he didn't want me to do too much research about bike culture because I'm playing a prospect.
El hermano menor, a new prospect.
Easy.
Then I'm playing this guy who was never supposed to be part of that world.
Gas it up and detail it. I don't want to see a speck of dust, huh? And my guys too.
So he wanted me to learn on the day and through the experiences of the MC, and that would be an honest portrayal of the character. What I wanted to focus on was how prison had affected Easy.
I'm looking at 20 years, son. Life is done.
So in order for the audience to believe it, I have to believe it.
The day the DEA has enough to move on that cartel is the day that I walk away. From you, the MC, this town, all of it, I get my f***ing life back.
I dive into it. I feel like I have this survival mechanism, this thing that makes me push forward and survive, and not just survive, but a desire to be great and to make an impact. And I think Easy has that too.
J.D. Pardo stars in the new TV series Mayans MC, which airs on the FX network. And that's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Additional editing this week by Fernanda Chavarri and Nadia Raymond. Our engineers are Jeannie Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Additional engineering this week by Rebecca Weinman. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our intern is Paula Moura. And this week we have some news about our amazing Dominican-American producer and engineer, Jeannie Montalvo, who is taking on an amazing new opportunity. But you know, Jeannie, we're going to miss you, whether it's orchestrating that ugly Christmas sweater staff photograph, or whether it's taking me on a southern road trip, or whether it's your latest fabulous piece about the history of Latino musicals on Broadway. I'm going to miss talking about your little baby. I'm going to miss you suddenly singing a Broadway tune. But we know you're not going far. Thank you for everything, Jeannie, and we'll see you around. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next time. And in the meanwhile, look for us on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by California Endowment, building a strong state by improving the health of all Californians. The Annie E. Casey Foundation creates a brighter future for the nation's children by strengthening families, building greater economic opportunity, and transforming communities. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Feel like I'm on the radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a better, more just society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. This is NPR.